I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity, so we saved you some time to get right to the good stuff. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Yesterday afternoon, in his inaugural address, Governor Phil Scott urged lawmakers to develop a collaborative approach in dealing with the major issues facing the state. Scott said this approach would be in stark contrast to the situation in Washington, D.C., where he says, quote, there's a national political environment that's brought out the worst in the public process.
The good is in our hearts. It's in our minds. And it's who we've always been. Today, more than ever, it's who America needs us to be. And to meet the challenges ahead to best serve Vermonters, it's who we have to be. And when the work gets difficult, when tensions build, which they will, when divisions seem too deep to overcome, when we need to be reminded that there's still good in the world, look no further than the people of Vermont.
How much is the governor willing to compromise to achieve consensus on a number of controversial issues, and what will be the impact if this collaborative approach is not successful? These are a few of the questions we have today for our guest, Governor Phil Scott. Governor, welcome back to the program.
Oh, good afternoon, Bob.
Great to have you here.
Well, thanks very much for having me on.
Let's start off with this federal government shutdown, which is about to enter its fourth week. What are your concerns about the way that the shutdown is impacting various programs and many people in the state of Vermont?
Well, it's just a disruption that doesn't need to happen, I don't believe. I think that they should have come together in some capacity to make this work instead of holding everyone somewhat hostage as a result. Keep in mind, this is a partial shutdown. It's not a full-blown shutdown, so it doesn't impact every sector and doesn't impact all our agencies, but it is going to have an effect eventually. We're working on a contingency plan at this point. I've asked all the secretaries and commissioners to take a fresh look to be sure that we can protect Vermonters, and we prioritize needs as well. So I wouldn't have guessed that it would have gone on this long. But there's so much uncertainty in this political world today that I shouldn't be surprised.
Have you expressed your concerns to the White House?
Obviously, yes. I mean, we continue whenever we have dialogue with them, which isn't frequent. But we're this disruption, this uncertainty isn't good for our economy. It's not good for our people. And again, this could have an effect on each of our states. The good news is we've positioned ourselves well. And when I say we, over the last couple of decades with reserves and so forth, so we can we'll be okay for a while. And we're better off than most states, most New England states in particular. So that's the good news. When we have other states, bigger states, that are going to run out of cash, so to speak, earlier or faster than we are, it puts a lot of pressure on those bigger states to reach out as well. So I think it's going to take us working together again. I'm reaching out to the National Governors Association, the chair and the vice chair, Democrat and Republican, have reached out and publicly with a letter said that we need to come to resolution on this, and this will hurt our states. So we're on record as voicing our opposition.
So yesterday afternoon, you talked about a collaborative approach to get issues solved at the state level. Let's take that approach and use it at the federal level. Would that mean that the government would reopen and then the Republicans and the president and the Democrats would start to negotiate over a longer-term immigration deal?
I think there's always a path to consensus. I think you just have to have an open mind, and I'm not sure what that path would be for them. I'm not in the thick of things, so to speak. But if it were me in this situation, I would be negotiating some sort of deal, something that I want. If I was the Democrats, I might ask for something grander, or maybe DACA something, and reduce the amount for the so-called wall or border security. But again, I'll leave that to them. But I'm confident there's always a path to consensus if you work hard enough.
Last year, you vetoed a number of bills that had been passed by the Democratic House and Senate. I'm thinking now of your consensus approach this year. Does this mean that you're going to look at some of these issues? There are things like paid family leave, raising the state minimum wage. Does it mean that you're willing to alter your position a little bit on these issues?
Well, it takes both sides, right? Compromise isn't just one way. I'm looking for a more collaborative process for both of us to figure out and contemplate what's really important and look for ways for common goals. I think in terms of like paid family leave, I believe we both have the same goals. I think that it would be helpful for us and it could be a marketing tool. But I believe there's another path, a volunteer approach. And I look forward to outlining that in the next couple of weeks. And so if we agree on the goal, then there should be some way to get there and accomplish something that we both can live with.
You're backing a voluntary approach where employees who would like this benefit can contribute to the program. But Senate President Tim Ash says this is an unrealistic approach because insurance programs like this one need the participation of all workers to be successful.
Most experts believe that you cannot have a successful program if it's voluntary because too few people will participate and there won't be enough funds for people to benefit.
Isn't that the sort of the nut of the issue here, that if you do a voluntary approach, you don't have enough people in the program to pay out the benefits?
I totally understand his concerns and skepticism. I look forward to outlining in detail what the proposal actually looks like. I haven't spoken to him about this in specifics. So look forward to doing so in the next couple of weeks, and then we'll go from there.
So in your budget address in 2 weeks, are you going to come up with and unveil a plan for voluntary paid family leave that you think will meet the needs of the people of Vermont?
Yes. Yes. We'll be outlining that in the budget address.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Julia, who is calling from Stowe. Hi, Julia. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, and thank you, Governor Scott, for being willing to take my call. It's actually very apropos because I was going to call and ask about family leave, medical leave. I'm a small business owner, and, you know, I was really disappointed that it was vetoed last year and am concerned about the opt-in approach versus the publicly funded system. And I guess I would just ask about your willingness to, you know, support a publicly funded system if that's what the legislature chooses as the right way rather than vetoing it a second time. And also, could you speak to making sure that medical leave is also included so that we have a wider pool of people who can draw from that benefit?
Well, thanks for the call, Julia. And again, I'm keeping an open mind. I would hope that the legislature would do the same to listen to the ideas, the approach, and not just automatically discount this proposal before they even heard of it. And I would ask you to do the same because I believe this is an approach that will work. And I believe that a lot of businesses who have concerns about this mandated approval process that was passed last year that I did veto, they felt that, and I believe the JFO, the Joint Fiscal Office, had highlighted the fact that they believe that it was underfunded as well, that this was just assuming too small a number in terms of the dollars that it would take to run the program. So, again, I'm, you know, this is a clean slate. We're going to pitch our proposal. We've been working very diligently and hard on this, and I have a team working on this, and I believe it can work. And so we'll make our case to the legislature.
Using this collaborative approach, it's interesting. Down in Massachusetts, we have somewhat of a similar situation. You have a Republican governor and you have Democratic majorities both in the House and the Senate down there. They're also looking at this issue, paid family leave, raising the state minimum wage. And they came up last summer with what they called the grand bargain. And the idea was everybody gets something of what they want. Maybe they get 75 or 80% of what they want. So included in the deal was a plan for paid family leave that would be paid for both by employees and employers. There's a state minimum wage going up to $15 an hour over a five-year period. The governor wanted a sales tax-free holiday. That was very important to him, as well as some other restructuring of the tax system in Massachusetts. Could you see that approach being used in Vermont?
Well, again, a collaborative approach, reaching consensus, everyone getting something, I think is important to any negotiation. And I would, I believe, and you might know this better than I do, but I believe the governor has line item veto in Massachusetts. That makes a big difference because then you get to negotiate in terms of what you want, what they want, and so forth. So, but that's the type of approach that I believe that we should seek, and that's one that I hope we can have. I've worked. Throughout my entire political career, I've served in the minority. I've reached across the aisle a lot over the last couple of decades, and we've had success. We've been able to accomplish a lot, and I look forward to doing so in the future, and I believe we can. There's a path forward here.
You know, I guess what I'm wondering is, rather than take it on a case-by-case basis, would you consider the possibility of saying, okay, here are three or four issues. We've been disagreeing about various aspects of it. But if we put them all together in a package, everybody gets a little bit of what they want. Is that kind of approach something you might look at?
You never know. Let's find out what the proposals are and make sure that there is an appetite for that in the legislature. And again, I would like the opportunity to present our side and our approach because it may be something that they hadn't contemplated either. So I look forward, again, to working with them and coming up with proposals that we both share, the common goals that I believe exist, and that we move forward in that way and show how we can work together.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Susan, who's calling from Burlington. Hey, Susan, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, and hello, Governor.
Hello.
I wanted to tell you that I'm impressed how you've been supporting early child care all along in your governorships, and I just want to hope that you continue. I'm glad to hear that you talked about it in your address, making child care more affordable for all young families. I worked in child care for 37 years here in the state, and it just doesn't seem to be getting any better for those young families and their children. Increasing child care availability is incredibly important. Those babies need to get really good child care, quality child care. And we're so low in this state. The access to that is so low to affordable. And even if you could pay $1 million, you couldn't get a good child care center in most of our counties. That's really shameful. Attracting and retaining talented educators, early educators, is so important, and it's really getting more and more difficult because the wages are so low. And I guess part of that thing mix would be working with businesses to make them understand how important it is and giving some kind of incentives for them from the state. So I feel important that you continue to work both sides of the aisle to bring this big issue to some kind of success. Move it right along. Thank you.
All right, Susan, thank you very much for your phone call. Really, Susan raises two somewhat different issues. One is the affordability of childcare. If you talk to families, working families around the state, it is astronomical, especially if they have two children or three children, or even just with one child. It can be an expense that ranks up with their mortgage payments if they're fortunate enough to have a house. So there's the affordability question, which is very difficult for a lot of families. And then there's accessibility, which is another question altogether that many folks are finding there just aren't enough childcare centers for the number of families that need those services.
Yeah, I agree. We need to focus more, I believe, on early care and learning. I believe that, you know, a child's brain develops immensely fast from 0 to 5. And that is when we need to get to them. I mean, the data is real. The science is real. And we should do a better job in that respect. And that's why I'm putting forth the proposal. I identified source of money, this Wayfair additional money, the sales tax on internet sales. And I believe that should go towards early care and learning. We should do a better job as well trying to break down the silos that exist between the Agency of Education and the Agency of Human Services, because both are working in this field, and sometimes they're not connected. And so we're working on that initiative as well. So we're trying to do what we can. There was some regulation that was put forward, some legislation that was passed a few years ago that really did some harm in some respects to child care in Vermont and in terms of capacity. And I'm looking for some way that we can work together in order to provide more early care and learning for kids.
In your speech yesterday, you also talked about proposing a long-term water quality proposal that would provide tens of millions of dollars over a 20-year period that would use existing revenues. So does this mean relying more heavily on the state's capital fund?
You know, I'm committed to water quality, and I believe we've come a long ways in the last two or three years. We committed a record level of funding over the last 2 years, and I'm committed to doing more in the future. We need to come up with a source. I've identified a source that I believe will work, a long term source with existing resources, and I'll be laying that out in a couple of weeks as well. But I think it has merit.
I've heard that you're looking at the estate tax. Is that one of the possibilities?
Everything's on the table. I've got a plan that I'm going to release in a couple of weeks, and it's a combination of another number of different factors. But again, I think it has some merit.
I guess I wonder about the estate tax. Is it reliable enough? You know, some years the state all of a sudden gets a lot of money because a couple of very wealthy people have died. Other years it doesn't turn out that way. So do you consider that to be a reliable source of money?
Well, again, I'll lay out my proposal in a couple of weeks, and then we can have that discussion.
Let's talk to Robert, who's calling from Bethel. Hey, Robert, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, thank you. Hey, congratulations, Governor.
Oh, thank you very much, Bob.
By the way, I have all your signs for your next run here, about 50 of them, so we're
well,
good to go.
Thank you.
But hey, I wanted to talk about what I call the elephant in the classroom, meaning the supervisory unions across the state. We have 53 of them. You know, the schools are contracting. And I don't see much contraction being done with the supervisory personnel. We're spending about $500,000 a piece at 53. So you're getting up close to the billion, well, a lot of money. And the other question I have was, over here in Rochester, our supervisory union is actually in South Royalton, right off the highway, when we're spending $58,000 a year to house them there. Meanwhile, we have a gigantic building in Rochester that's perfect for supervisory offices. That's idle. And so the last caller, I think it's really important to, if we're going to spend the money on education, we should transfer the huge amount of money being sent or spent by the or paid to the supervisory unions and transfer that to early child care. So there's two things. Like the money, I'd rather see the money contraction in layoffs at the supervisory level. I don't think we need all that supervision for the size of the state and the amount of the schools. And logically put the supervisory unions in the empty buildings, which are laying vacant and probably rotting. And then also, you know, take a big chunk of that money and really focus it on early child care. Because if there's no education for children, there's no economy. I mean, that's a done deal. And we're in a bad position with our young folks. I know some of the child care people that had child care centers, the rules and regs became so intense for them, they said, forget it, I'm not doing it. And that's why no one can find child care.
Okay, Robert. Really Robert, you've raised a lot of good issues. Governor, what about Robert's thoughts?
Yeah, well, a lot of good points. And the rules and regulations were something that I had talked about in the previous with the previous caller that we hope that we can make some gains on there. as well. You know, that's part of Act 46 was a consolidation process, governance consolidation. I take his point with the supervisory districts and the overhead that exists there, and I'm sure we'll have those conversations as well. Trying to invest more in early care and learning, I think, is something, a goal we should all agree on, and trying to find opportunities to get there. Because, again, if we can give them a good foundation at that critical point in their life, we can have benefits not only for them in their future, part of their success, the cradle to career approach that I've advocated for. But also on some of the demands on state government in different capacities, and I believe that this would help put them on the right path to success.
You mentioned Act 46, a plan by the State Board of Education to require a number of school districts to merge. Now is in the court system. You've said that you don't think the State Board of Education should have this authority. So why not? And who should?
Well, that question was about, you know, if I was doing this over from my standpoint, I just didn't feel that it was an unelected board that doesn't answer to anybody really should have that authority. That was just my feeling. But we don't, I mean, we're too far down the road at this point to do anything different. It was just my philosophical approach from my standpoint. But we'll see what happens from here. A number of districts have already gone through a lot to get here. This wasn't my idea. Act 46 wasn't something that I created. It wasn't something that I crafted. I didn't even have a vote on it. But
you supported it.
But I supported the concept of doing something. Because I give great credit to those because they finally came to the conclusion, as I keep advocating for, we have fewer students that we're educating now, 30,000 fewer students than we did just 20 years ago. So they had to take some action. And this is what they came up with. And again, it's not perfect. It wasn't something that I would have crafted, but it was put forth by the legislature, signed by the governor. It's law. And now I have an obligation, as our administration does, to follow the law. And that's what we're trying to do at this point. So I would say, I mean, if you took the population of districts who have gone through and done their mergers, it's probably in the 90% range in terms of population who have done this. For us to turn back at this point, I think it would cause so much disruption, and it's a parity issue. It's and unfair to those who again went and struggled through this to conform.
There's going to be legislation introduced at the State House that would say that if the local towns vote against a merger, even if the State Board of Education calls for a forced merger, if voters in those communities say no, we don't want to do it, then it doesn't happen. Could you support that bill?
Well, I'll take a look at it, obviously. There are some, you know, take Stowe, for instance, Stowe and Morrisville and Elmore. I think the Secretary of Education offered her opinion. It was the former secretary and said that they shouldn't merge. The State Board of Education said they should. So we'll see where it goes with the legislature. Obviously, these are difficult discussions to have, and I wish it was something different. I wish we had more students. I wish we hadn't lost 30,000 students over the last 20 years, and that's what. But we have to have the courage to think outside the box and deal with what's before us, and then move forward. And that's why I keep talking about doing something with our demographics. We need to do more to help ourselves out of the situation we find ourselves in. We need more people here. We need more families here because there are jobs available that we don't have the workers for. And we also have capacity in our school system to educate more kids.
Is thinking outside of the box, would that include saying, hey, let's just have one school district in Vermont?
Well, that came up this week when I chose Dan French, our new Secretary of Education. He has a great background. He was a teacher, an educator. He was a principal. He was a superintendent. And he has, so he had boots on the ground. He understands the system, so to speak. So I asked him to be creative, be bold, you know, come forth and let's contemplate different ideas. So he's done so. I mean, working behind the scenes, so to speak, and coming up with different thoughts about where we might go in the future. I don't think we're ready for anything like that at this point. But again, it's something I give him great credit for at least bringing this up and talking about it because the way we're doing it right now doesn't work. It's not working. And we're spending a tremendous amount of money and not getting the results that our kids deserve.
We got this email from Shauna who wrote us, "I'm self-employed and work from home. Several years ago, I was able to relocate from Connecticut to the Northeast Kingdom because they had broadband access. Rural economic growth and development cannot happen without internet connectivity. What is your plan to bring high-speed internet to rural Vermont?" This has been an issue that has probably plagued several governors over the last 10 or 15 years.
Well, it's expensive, and it's very difficult. I mean, we talk about two separate things, cell service and broadband. And sometimes they intertwine, and many people are talking about both. So other governors have made promises about what they would do and not do, and it's difficult as they found out to follow through on. I haven't made those promises, but I will say this is another economic tool in the toolbox, but it's not the total answer. We had a presentation on broadband in Vermont and where we're at. And when I was shocked to find out, when I learned that in the top 10 communities throughout Vermont that had the highest speed, highest capacity broadband, it wasn't a surprise to see Burlington on the list, but it was a surprise to me to see Brattleboro, Springfield, Newport, not exactly thriving economic centers in our state, but they have the highest capacity right now. Hancock was on the list. So that's not the total answer is my point, but it is something that we have to do a better job. So we'll be, again, in my budget address, we'll be proposing what I would do and moving forward on this, because I think it is necessary for the future to encourage more, bring more people to the state.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Sister Lorian, who's calling from Berlin. Sister Lorian, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm concerned about the cleanness of our waters. And you've already spoken about, or you've already said you will speak in 2 weeks about our lakes, but I'm hoping you're not forgetting our groundwater. Many, many Vermonters rely on water from wells, both municipal and private. And we need to know that our water is safe. Are you doing something about this?
Well, continually. Thanks for calling in. Water is a tremendous resource, and we shouldn't take it for granted. Our Agency of Natural Resources and our Department of Health, I think, do a tremendous job in this respect. Do we need to do better? For one, yes. I mean, look at we're moving forward. There was a pilot project accomplished by the Department of Health and the Agency of Natural Resources, I believe. Both were involved, but maybe it was just the Department of Health. But there was a pilot project for some schools in Vermont, and we learned that there were some schools who had detected lead in their water system. Now the appropriate question is, how many others do? So I challenged the legislature to work with me so that we could do this in a short period of time. And look for what are we, trying to prioritize? Where are our problem areas, and what can we do to prevent lead from entering the water systems or be in the water systems themselves? So we'll be moving forward with that. I'm confident this is an area that we both agree on, and I think we can move forward on.
Let's talk about tax and regulating of marijuana. Special Commission issued its report last month. You've said all along that one of your major concerns is driver impairment, and that issue needs to be addressed. Now, the commission discussed many difficulties in setting up a marijuana impairment measurement process because marijuana reacts differently in different people. The panel did recommend, though, that a saliva test be used when a law enforcement officer had reasonable cause to suspect that a driver is impaired. Are you satisfied with that recommendation? And so are you now prepared to support a tax and regulate system?
Well, there's a couple of things there. I certainly am concerned. I think public safety is our primary concern, should be the paramount paramount concern to any government. And I believe impairment on our highways is something that we should all be concerned with. And it's not just about marijuana, just not just about pot. It's about, you know, a combination of alcohol and pot and prescription drugs. So even in other states, such as Colorado, that do have a limit, a THC limit of some sort, I don't know whether it's 5 or 10 nanograms or whatever it is, you could be under that limit and then be under the limit for alcohol and then be taking prescription drugs and be impaired. So we need to determine impairment on the highways, regardless of the substance. And I believe that this is just one more tool in the toolbox to determine that. So moving forward on that, I think, is important. I also have said in the past that we need to do a better job in educating our kids. That has to be part of anything that we do as we move forward. And we'll see. I mean, I just, from my standpoint, don't understand the rush here. And I don't believe it satisfies our economic needs. I don't think that that should be why we're doing this. And we should learn from other states. They're going through this. Others are going through this in real time, and we should learn from them. And that's what my concern is, that we just – Let's do this. If we're going to do this, let's go into this with our eyes wide open. Make sure that we're doing it for the right reasons and do it in a thoughtful manner so that we don't put anybody at risk.
Is part of the rush that some people feel the fact that it's happening in Massachusetts, it's happening in Maine, it's happening in Canada, it's coming. So you really can't avoid it. Do you want people from Vermont going to Massachusetts and then coming back into the state having purchased marijuana there? Isn't that part of the rush?
I still don't see the rush, to be honest with you. And again, we've decriminalized marijuana. You can have up to an ounce and not be cited. You can grow your own in Vermont. We've legalized that last year. And again, let's get this right. If we're going to do this, let's get it right because we have the opportunity, the time to do it. They didn't have in Massachusetts. That was done by referendum. Same in Maine and other states as well, all by referendum. I think if they had their way, even in Colorado, which was one of the first, I think in looking back over the years, if they had, they might do things a lot differently today than they did then. I think the governor would tell you that, or the former governor. So let's make sure that we're learning as we go here, and let's do it the right way. And I'm not saying no. I just think that we can take our time, make sure that we get this right, and so that we don't put undue harm to the people of Vermont.
So would it be fair to say that you don't think the recommendations of the Special Commission necessarily address this issue in a specific enough way?
No, I think they did some great work within the commission. And I think that we have the opportunity. They mentioned, the impairment on highways. They mentioned the education portion. I think that we need to act on that. Let's put those in place. Let's move forward because they do exist. And your reasoning in terms of surrounding us is valid. Canada, New York is talking about going to something. I'm not sure what they're going to do, but Governor Cuomo has talked about going to some sort of, I don't know if it's a decriminalization or it's a tax and regulate system. I don't know what they're doing. But then again, Massachusetts and Maine are doing the same. So it's surrounding us. We need to address it. Let's make sure that we take care of the first steps and prioritize and not make this about money.
So Senate President Tim Ash says he'd like to see the Senate consider a tax and regulate bill in the next 4 or 5 weeks. So there's an opportunity to pass this legislation during the 2019 session. Is that timetable too quick for you?
Well, again, I don't think that's any surprise. They passed it a couple times over the last 2 or 3 years. So I have no doubt that they'll move forward with it, and then the House will take it up. And I'll consider anything that comes across my desk. So let's work together. I'm advocating for that. I mean that. And we'll try and address the concerns that I have as it continues to move through the legislative process.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to John, who's calling from Montpelier. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I agree with some of the governor's points, and there seems to be a lot of myth on revenue streams coming in from a taxation if it passed. But that's a myth. I mean, California, it's almost a law. There's a lot of research on this. It's 1% of the Colorado revenue. And then that money goes into drug prevention campaigns, alcohol and tobacco prevention campaigns, which this state spends quite a bit of money on, alcohol, abuse, addiction. And here we are talking about a drug that impairs and pushing for recreational sales. I think this state, for our children's sake, for a future we should stay clean, healthy, organic, and drug-free.
Okay, John, we appreciate your phone call. You know, it was interesting. The commission did look at the whole idea of how much revenue would be generated by a tax and regulate system. And maybe a year or two ago, I remember people throwing out numbers like, well, maybe $50 million in new revenue. Who knows? If it's very popular, it might be $80 million in new revenue. And I think the commission's final conclusion was, no, it's not going to be anything close to that. It might be down more in the 50 to $20 million range, and it's going to cost the state money to set up a regulated system, and the commission wants to put money into public education and prevention. So in the end, there really isn't a lot of money there.
Well, exactly, and I think you have to be careful in that respect. I think I read somewhere, maybe it was California, that has high taxes on marijuana, and they're finding that the black market still exists as a result. So it's a balance there. You don't. I remember going to some function. It was in the last couple of years, and it was a social function. And someone came up to me and somebody I'd known and said something to the effect that he wanted to talk about tax and regulate. And I thought he was advocating for it. And he said, look, I want to tell you one thing. He said, I'm not going to pay tax on my pot. He said, I'll continue to get it from where I'm getting it now. I'm not going to pay 20 or 25%. I'm not going to adhere. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. So there are a sector of people that are quite content doing what they're doing today without going to paying more for what they're getting.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Mark, who's calling from Fletcher. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm referring back to the previous conversation about education and how it's impacting our economy. And I'm sure the governor remembers the Regional Technical Academy initiative, which would have put us right where we need to be right now if we had followed through. And it became a very fraught political football that went from state-of-the-art, freestanding AP, all-inclusive college and technical arts and sciences. Not a vocational school, but although a lot of those subjects were elevated to a newer level. And it was just reduced to a dumping ground of 2 years for non-college kids with no athletics, no clubs. And this kind of reflects on what a lot of people think, government thinks about education. It would have suited what we're at right now much better than trying to recruit cherry-picked specialists to fill that gap when it could have been a steady stream of tax-paying local people. And I'm wondering what the governor's going to do about that. And early education is part of that, too.
Okay, Mark, we're almost out of time, but Governor?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think we could do a better job in terms of career technical education facilities. And I do think that we have to eliminate the stigma that exists. Putting everything under one roof, I think, makes a tremendous amount of sense, more of a campus-type approach where everyone gets something out of it. We're not all destined for master's degrees. We need to provide for a cradle-to-career type approach to benefit every student. And so that's what I keep advocating for. Let's focus on the kids. What are their needs? What can we do for them? And then move from there to how do we implement something that will be most beneficial to all students.
This is a session where constitutional amendments can be introduced. There's going to be one extending the governor's term to 4 years. What's your feeling about that?
Yeah, no, I think it's a good idea. There could be – it's interesting when you talk to former governors. Everyone has a different opinion on that. But from my standpoint, it's particularly the first 4 years, I think is difficult to find, you know, someone to sign up for what could possibly be just 2 years to put on your team, so to speak, and getting your legs underneath you and trying to establish that. I think it's difficult. I've always been an advocate for a four-year term. I just want to say a 4-year term would probably not benefit me in any way. So this isn't self-serving whatsoever.
But the idea that that you need to attract people to your administration in the last 60 years, there's only been one governor who has been defeated in an effort to win re-election. So isn't the reality that any governor who gets elected, they're going to get 4 to 6 years anyway?
But you go through the process and then you spend a year during that time campaigning. And you're spending a lot of money to do so. If we talk about campaign finance all the time. We're spending too much on elections, but yet we're advocating to have it done twice in a 4-year period. We're one of only two states who still has two-year terms, and I think there's a reason for that. So I think we can do better.
What about lawmakers? Do they get a 4-year term too?
I think that's where it always breaks down. We passed it out of the Senate a few years ago. And it got over the House, and everyone wanted a 4-year term at that point. I think you should stick to the constitutional offices.
And not have a 4-year term for either the House or the Senate.
No, I think it would break down at that point.
We'll certainly be following many of these issues in the days and weeks ahead. Governor Phil Scott, many thanks for taking the time to be on the program today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Looking forward to your budget address in 2 weeks, where you'll be making some very specific proposals about a lot of the issues that you talked about today.
Stay tuned.